Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Hi there, this is Alan Shark, and welcome to another episode of Shark Bites. This is the first episode in the year 2021, so hopefully you had a happy new year, and looking forward to a much better year than perhaps we had last year. As you know, the podcast delves into leadership among CIOs and other tech leaders throughout local government, to some extent state government. And today we are very fortunate to have John Walton. John is the Chief Information Officer of the County of San Mateo in California. I've known him for over a decade, and he is getting all these awards and whatnot, and it seemed like this is an appropriate time to really have a chat and to share the discussion with you. John brings over 25 years of experience in the field of information technology, has a diverse background in both public and private sectors, setting innovative technology standards and providing visionary leadership for numerous organizations. He's received tons of awards, and most recently, State Tech recognized him as one of the 30 people to watch in the year 2020. Now, it came out towards late in the year, so hopefully he'll make the list again in 2021. But he's done a lot of things, and hopefully we'll get into that. For example, I believe you've been on a school board, you have been a race car driver, so you have a lot of interest. So, John, welcome.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here, and I really enjoy having the opportunity to talk with you. I've enjoyed our friendship and partnership over the years, and I'm really excited for 2021.
Yeah, it's got to be better than last year. It's such an anomaly, such a different year. It can only get better. So, John, I always ask when we begin these discussions, I always believe that very few of us wake up in high school or even college and say, when I grow up and when I go into the adult workforce, I want to be a chief information officer. So I'm always curious to know, how did you get to where you are? You've had a really great career, and it's far from over. So if you would, you've had an interesting journey. So let's spend a couple of minutes talking about, how did you get to the County of San Mateo?
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, that's a great question, and probably the most complex question you're going to ask me today. So I will try to keep it to a couple of minutes. It was a long, winding road to end up where I ended up. I grew up in a family that was a military family. My dad was in missile defense. And so we moved a lot, as you can imagine. And my dad used to like to say we lived in places where people didn't care where he blew things up. So it was rather rural and isolated. And I wasn't into computers at all. Matter of fact, I'm of an age where computers were still a relatively new thing. So my exposure to computers was really through, my dad was a bit of what you would call a hoarder now. So every time they would demo out a test site, he felt terrible about all the expensive computer equipment that was getting thrown away, PDP-11s and things like that. So he would haul them home in his pickup truck. And I grew up with garage full of old mainframe computers, Wangs and IBMs. And so those were my toys. Those were my friends growing up. But to be honest, that didn't really interest me. I really love nature. And so when I teach classes at San Francisco State and things like that to MBA students, I always tell them to become a CIO, the first thing you do is you go to Humboldt State University and get a degree in natural resource science, because that's where every good CIO starts, is with a degree in natural resources. And that's really how my career got started. I really wanted to be a researcher, a scientist. I wanted to study nature and the environment. And at that time, the college was implementing VAX computer systems. That was a new thing. And it turned out that I wasn't really great at school. I guess you would probably call it ADD now, but I don't do well sitting in classes listening. But it turns out I'm really good at setting up VAXs for all the computer labs. So all the professors would give me extra credit to make up for my poor test scores by going in and configuring all the computers in the labs. And so that was really how my career started. I did get a bachelor's degree in science. I enjoyed that. But immediately after college, I started setting up computer systems for counties and cities and private industry. And it just went from there. And in those days, it was really what you did. You just sort of went from project to project, and it was word of mouth. And if you knew anything about computers, that kind of put you a leg up on the competition. And so, voila, here I am now. I'm a CIO of a great county here in California. I'm appreciative of all the recognition our county gets. I think it's really a reflection of the hard work, the staff here does and the leadership of the county, the supervisors and the city manager. I think I have probably the best, easiest CIO job in California. They make things very easy for me.
Well, I met one of your deputies at a recent meeting, and there you do have a very talented staff.
I do.
So tell us, I didn't read somewhere about this racing car thing. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, so that's, like I said, the technology thing wasn't really a passion of mine when I was young. And my dad, as a hobby, was an amateur stock car racer. So I grew up around racetracks and engineers, as it turns out. You know, he was an engineer, and engineers love to build things. And so he loved to build cars and fix cars. So I grew up working on cars and building cars and race cars, and have always been around those. And so that's always been my hobby. As a matter of fact, I was an auto mechanic when I was paying my way through college, because I had an aptitude for that. And it's really just built from there. I think from my childhood, as an executive in technology, really I spend most of my time, unfortunately, you know, in meetings, in office buildings, working on spreadsheets, PowerPoints. You know, it's not as glamorous as probably some people think it is to be a CIO, for me at least. And I really enjoy kind of the tactile, visceral. I build my own race cars, I tune them, I drive them on the track. It's really a release for me. And of all the things I do, it's probably the things that helps me, like too many of us in this world nowadays, we all try to multitask too much. We're in meetings and checking email and texting. I will say, if you ever need to focus, there's nothing like being at a racetrack doing 130 miles an hour going into a turn to cause you to focus and not worry about who's texting you or calling you on the phone. So I still love it. I've sold most of my cars now. I have two left, and I still do it when I have the time, but it's less and less these days. COVID has kept us very busy, and I have two young sons that I try to spend as much time with as I can. So until they get interested in racing, then I probably won't spend as much time at the track as I have in the past.
The reason why I mention it now, for me, it's boating, but I believe that having hobbies and having an intense interest in something outside of work is very healthy to keep us grounded. So I think, you know, your comment is well taken. And in talking to many of the peers that we both share, it seems that many of us who are successful do have some kind of hobby, something that one would not even expect, perhaps, to kind of make sure that we have some interests that keep us grounded and give us a perspective. There are other things out there. So here we are, the beginning of a new year. 2020 was the year of Zoom. And here we are Zooming, recording Shark Bites, the podcast. This was a year where I consider this called the great pivot. In regards to the fact, we wake up one morning, it's March, and we realize that something is changing and we have to change very quickly. What was that like for you? Because there was a really loud alarm bell going off there that we need to pivot very quickly to a remote kind of environment. How prepared were you, and how did you handle that?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I think you're right. I think 2020 with the pandemic really was a tipping point for a lot of us in the government IT industry. I know it was for us. I feel like, again, we were a little fortunate here in San Mateo County that because we try to be forward-looking and we try to be innovative, we were at least starting down the road of having a more robust network. We had policies already in place around telework. We had some nascent tools we had implemented to a limited extent for making multi-factor authentication and VPN access easier than it had been in the past. But we really hadn't done that at a large scale. We talk about Zoom. We had just moved from GroupWise to Office 365 with Teams. And so we got lucky, to be honest with you. I'd like to say it was because I'm a genius and it was great planning, but sometimes luck trumps all of that. And so for us, we activated our Emergency Operations Center in February. And almost immediately thereafter, the county manager asked all the employees, to the extent that they could, you know, given the fact that we run hospitals and jails, obviously it wasn't all employees, but to telework from home and shelter in place. And for my staff and team, really what that meant was the things we had done at a small scale, where maybe 15 or 20% of the countywide workforce, which is about 9,000 employees, suddenly 80% of those were going to be teleworking. And so we had the same challenges, I think, a lot of cities and counties did, where First, there was a supply chain issue of could we get enough devices? For us, that meant having to swallow our pride in a sense. We were, you know, we were tried to be historically very firm about what our technology standards were when it came to hardware. When COVID hit, you know, any piece of any laptop we could lay our hands on suddenly became our standard overnight, right? We had to learn to adapt very quickly. The whole BYOD debate went by the wayside overnight. If you had your own device at home, we were going to take advantage of that and enable it. We allowed staff to take desktops home and monitors home and printers home so that they could be productive. So that conversation went by the wayside. We had some very good vendors, Microsoft and Zscaler and others and Palo Alto Networks that helped us rapidly scale up overnight, you know, true up our licenses later to give us enough licenses that everyone could telework right away. I really have to give credit to my staff. At one point, you know, we're about 150 IT people supporting 9,000. So we were basically split into three shifts and everybody was working around the clock to get everybody set up. And, you know, it was a big push and the staff did a great job. I think there was very little loss in productivity. People adapted quickly. The employees did a great job. You know, security and network access became much more important overnight than some of the other things we had been working on. So we really shifted our focus into that. And it's gone a lot smoother than I thought it would. There have continued to be some challenges. I think we are now in that place, you know, with the second surge coming through, we've had to address the fact that probably telework is here to stay to a much larger extent than we thought. You know, the idea that this was a temporary problem, we were going to do some things quickly and temporarily and then go back to the way it was. I think, you know, we've come to acceptance in that whole grieving model and accepted that, you know, the workforce as we know it and the facilities and the network designs and the security tools we use are going to have to be permanent and probably evolve based on this new workforce dynamic. Which, you know, in my opinion, and I hate to always try to look on the bright side of things, I don't want to seem too Pollyanna-ish about pandemics and things, but, you know, there has been benefits. Traffic is less, air quality is better. I think for some employees, you know, the quality of work-life balance is better because they can spend more time at home with their families. So I try to look for the good in these things, and I hope out of some of this tragedy and hardships that we've gone through as a country and as a county that, you know, we can find some good out of it and make good decisions for the future that will benefit us.
I fully agree, John. And two things that I hear is one, there is a positive side. You know, I teach, you teach as well. And my students have said they'd rather be in a classroom. I said, no, wait a minute. If you were in a classroom, you'd be wearing masks and I'd be behind a plexiglass window. I see you better in our weekly classes, you know, through a virtual environment. I can hear you better. I can see you better. Everybody's among equals. There's nobody in the back of the room. There are advantages. The other thing that I hear is the vendor community has really stepped up. They have been wonderful. I've not heard any complaints of any vendor. In fact, if anything, it's the opposite. They really came to help and bend backwards. But to what extent is that sustainable? You kind of pointed something out that worries many, and that is, what we thought might be somewhat temporary, that would might last to the end of the year, and now we're into a new year. I mean, this changes a lot of assumptions, telework being one, as we navigate the new normal. What are you worried about when it comes to the budget? Because many local governments always lag the economy. And while some pockets are still doing relatively well, we know that the revenues, you know, through the lack of taxes is really going to impact governments very, very severely. And it's usually like a 6-month lag. And of course, the CARES dollars have evaporated. Unemployment is kind of evaporating in some areas. I mean, what kind of cuts are you anticipating?
You know, Alan, I think you bring up a really good point. And you're right, it is a topic and a theme that I hear daily from my fellow CIOs. And I think one of the changes, you know, we always talk about the relevancy of a CIO position in an organization. And, you know, we've all read the articles that the CIO position is dead and is an anachronism and all that. And, you know, I understand those perspectives. I view my role in my organization, and I encourage my fellow CIOs to to reimagine themselves as more of a chief communications officer, chief education officer. And really very early in the process, in my organization at least, we started having those conversations about what would it mean if this was the new normal, right? Because staffing levels have changed and costs of solutions and network and tools have changed. And those increases in costs to support this new normal workforce, you know, are sort of a double whammy to your point. Costs are increasing and revenues, city or countywide, are decreasing. And so I've really viewed my job in the last 6 months. We're on a 2-year budget cycle, so we're actually just going into our new budget planning phase in January, that, you know, we have to really educate the elected officials and the other department heads about costs are going to increase and work with them to find ways to offset that, given the fact that it's going to be a double hit. It's going to be costs are increased, there's less revenues available. On the other hand, there's really all you can do is be very honest and transparent about that. We've dramatically shifted a lot of our workloads to the cloud, so it's a bit more elastic. It's very consumption-based. We spend a lot of time educating departments about there's choices they can make to help reduce revenue. When you're in a good budget cycle, everyone's got a desktop and a laptop and a desk phone and a cell phone and an iPad, right? Technology tends to multiply just like in our personal lives, but at work. We are an internal service fund, so we bill for every item. And so we've really tried to sit down and strategically plan with departments. You know, your users don't need 5 devices. You can probably reduce the number of devices you're paying for by half if we really just have the hard conversation about you don't need a desk phone and a cell phone. You can live with just one. So that's the types of things we're doing now. It's we're trying to, you know, work with our vendors to keep the costs as low as possible and based on a consumption model rather than sort of, you know, all you can eat models, and also just work with departments that we serve to really find ways to put them in charge of their bills. Just like in our personal lives, we all have choices to make, and we try to put the power to make those choices about expenses in the hands of the departments.
That's great. One of the things that has cropped up over the months is this whole idea of digital equity. I think we've spent so much time trying to pivot our workforce, our government workforce, to be better positioned to serve citizens. But then all of a sudden we start to realize that the digital divide was always there, but it's been further exposed because we it's such a reliance in getting information from us, and we in local government have a responsibility to report out things. And with the lack of many local newspapers that we could possibly count on in the past, we have a real chore here. And so I'm wondering, what kind of things have you done to try and address that? Because it has to be recognized that there are a lot of people that are in dire need of broadband. I mean, by some estimates, it could be as many as 40 million people in this country do not have access to reliable broadband.
That's a great question about digital equity, Alan. I think I want to step back and just, I guess, give some of my personal historic perspective on that. I think, you know, coming out of sort of the Bay Area, really cutting my teeth, I guess you would say, as a CIO and as leader in the Bay Area, you know, it is definitely a bubble, right? The level of access and inclusivity in the Bay Area, I think, first of all, is not reflective of, you know, some of the more rural parts of the country that I grew up in. So I think that's the first thing that is hard sometimes when people live, and most of our populations are centered in urban areas that possibly do have good options for broadband. Sometimes we forget the more underserved areas. The interesting thing for me, and I've been a deputy CIO and CIO in the city of San Jose, and then I was the CIO in San Francisco for several years before I came here. Over those years, probably 15, 20 years of my service, and I've really seen the trend go from, you know, 15 years ago, before the explosion of smartphones and things like that, you know, internet access was a luxury that only the VIPs received, or the very rich that could afford high-speed modems and subscription accounts to the internet. And I remember back when I was in San Jose, we talked about e-government and trying to slowly move government online. So now we fast forward to 2021. And there's, I think, probably an over success, maybe, if you will, that we've put so much online, right? That really all the healthcare, telehealth, and education, I mean, as we saw through COVID and continue to see, distance learning isn't a, well, if you would like to log into Google Classroom and do your homework at home, that's an option. It's a requirement now that every child have a device and have access to, you know, streaming video and Google Classroom, and that the parents may be required to stay home with their children and not be able to go to work, so they have to work from home. And if they're going to get good telehealth in a shelter-in-place environment or in a rural area, they have to have a device with connectivity. And so I think we've gone from a society where the internet was a nice to have, and we used to talk about digital divide and digital access just in a, isn't it too bad they don't have the access to these fun things that the rest of us have access to a really a requirement. It's really the lifeblood of society now, where if you do not have access to that, right? And it's really become a socioeconomic problem. And even in my county, which is probably one of the more wealthy per capita counties, I would imagine, in the country, we still have pockets where, you know, families make less than $30,000 a year. And in the Bay Area, you're not going to be able to afford unlimited bandwidth. And so 5 years ago, we started this journey and talking about, even then, we knew we had pockets of underserved. And we simply at that time wanted to try to create digital equity. We wanted to give them the opportunity not to have to make hard choices between high-speed internet access and, you know, paying their rent or buying food. And so we stood up 100 Wi-Fi sites around the county over the last 5 years before the pandemic started. And we had over 1 million user hours a month of public access on that public network. And so, you know, there's always the question, is it being used for entertainment or people streaming music, playing games, watching Netflix, or doing work? Both, I would say, right? Just like a public road, people drive on roads for entertainment to go to the movies, or they drive on the road to go to work. I mean, that's why I compare internet access really to a public utility, because it's really, I believe in a personal view, not the role of government to dictate how a public asset is used, as long as it's being used safely and in the best interest of the public good. And I think entertainment and enjoyment is one of those things that we deserve as individuals, right? So then the pandemic hit, and overnight, like we were saying, it really became a necessity. It was no longer a luxury where we will do our best effort to provide this to you. Schools, and I'm a school board trustee and sort of a part-time job outside my CIO job. And, you know, if you're going to require teachers to teach from home and you're going to require students to learn from home, then you have an obligation to provide them not just the device and the software, but really the means to connect. You can't put that onus on a teacher or a student or their family to have adequate connectivity to do something you're requiring them by law to do. So school districts, you know, we originally handed out hotspots. You know, that was kind of the ubiquitous solution to digital equity. I really view equity as kind of the three legs of connectivity, devices, and training. We were fortunate for a lot of our students and community that I think the benefit of the smartphone is everyone has a pretty good understanding of touchscreens and applications. You know, 15 years ago, we were training people how to use computers. I think most children are born with the ability to use an iPad now, it seems.
Beginning at the age of 3.
Yes, exactly. And I think, so connectivity really became a big thing. And I think that's still the challenge ahead of us, is we can probably solve through philanthropic and donation type of programs the one-to-one device problem. And it's not that it doesn't still exist, but I think there's more readily solutions to that, and the training as well. I think there's great organizations that do that, a lot of stuff online, but connectivity is still a huge issue. There's parts of my county, we're 580 square miles, that still don't have cell phone connectivity. You know, we've had fires out here and we're expecting floods and debris flows this winter when the storms come in, and there's pockets of our community down on the South Coast that don't even have cell phone connectivity. So how are we going to use, you know, the text alerting system for emergencies to reach those folks? So, you know, we're looking at a variety of different solutions. You know, hotspots work where you have a cell signal. We're looking at point-to-point microwave to try to reach back into some of these more rural areas. We're hopeful that some of these emerging technologies like Starlink and things like that will really help create hubs of connectivity in isolated areas. And so that's been a big focus. We've spent and about $6.8 million of CARES funds, pushing in partnership with school districts and libraries, public Wi-Fi out to about twice the area we were before. So we've doubled our hub sites, if you will, in the county for public Wi-Fi in 1 year. What we did in the first 5 years, we've basically done in the last 6 months.
You know, you're very fortunate. You're not one of the 22 states that ban Muni Wi-Fi. So you're allowed if you have the resources.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, that goes back to the educational piece. I recall when there was a lot of concern raised when I was in San Jose, for example, that municipal Wi-Fi was unfair competition with the telecommunications industry. And there's still some lagging, I would say, opinions or views on that, even here in the Bay Area. But I think we're fortunate that we partner very closely with our telecommunication partners, Comcast and AT&T and Verizon. And I think they've been very appreciative of the fact that where it's possible, we use them for backhaul for our public Wi-Fi. So they're partners with us on that. I think what has changed in society is telecommunications companies used to make the majority of their revenue off infrastructure, off connections. And so that's why I think there was a lot of lawsuits and concerns about that 15 or 20 years ago. Now, you know, when I talk to my friends at AT&T, they would much rather I do the infrastructure and bear that right. cost, and they make profit off the content. So
absolutely, because if they saw that they could make money by building out to these unserved areas, they would have. It's right. just economically not feasible, and that's where government comes in as a last resort. So yeah. it does make sense. So as we start the new year, what concerns you the most? What are the top three things that concern you as we move ahead into the new year?
Digital equity is still at the top of my list. I think because we're in this new normal for telework and distance learning, even with the pending vaccines that will get rolled out to the public, I still think we're in this new in dynamic of connectivity, and digital equity is a conversation here to stay. I don't think it's going to be a, we need to solve this problem during 2020, and now in 2021. We're going to put digital equity on the back burner. I think it was significant enough and eye-opening enough to every level of society that I think as CIOs, as municipalities, that's a problem we're here to solve. And I think with the new administration, that's recognized by both parties. I've seen a lot of bills and proposed bills that I think there's a shared view that this issue of access to the internet, and I know there's varying opinions on what broadband really means and should it be fiber to the home or wireless. I think there's different solutions to different areas. I don't think there's a silver bullet that fits everything, but I think from the federal to the state to the local level, everyone realizes that digital equity and access is critical. And for me, security is the second one. I think, like with all good comes risk, and the more people that are connected and the more we continue to push things, and we saw this during the elections. I know I spent a lot more time just in the last year on cybersecurity and election security probably than I had in my entire career. And I think, again, that's here to stay. I think the recognition that the cyber element of not just election systems, but information in general, misinformation and the management of that, is critical now. And so I think security and information management is going to be key as well.
Cool. Well, I wish you the best for the coming year. I want to thank you for participating in the first episode of Shark Bites of 2021. This is Alan Shark, and you've been listening to Shark Bites. If you haven't already, please subscribe. And we come out every other week on Thursdays. So by subscribing, you will be alerted to great speakers, conversationalists like John Walton, who is the Chief Information Officer of San Mateo County in California. It's been a pleasure, John. I hope to have you back again soon and see how we are, whether it's Zoom 2 or something else that propels us into this year.
It was great being here, Alan. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.